Ooh, and we're in the location of Koinonia Fireside, and this evening the presenter's name is Gail Ramshaw, and today's session is number RAG-2002-01, and it's titled 4 of 40, 40 Images in the Lectionary. Let's listen in.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
My name is Gail Ramshaw. I'm a Lutheran laywoman who cares a lot about, actually, I was a sophomore at Valparaiso University, and I didn't like the intercessions. And I told the chaplain I didn't like the intercessions. I don't know why I didn't like them, but I didn't like them. And he asked me to write the intercessions for the next midweek Eucharist at Valpo, and I did. And about a month later, he had arranged to hire me as a writer for the University Chapel. So that got me started in my, that's all I'm still doing, is writing prayers, or analyzing them, or reading what other Christians have prayed, and studying the scriptures for what's the history of prayer, or what can be our language of prayer. And of course, then during my 40 years of caring about this, have been the years that there has been so much change in the prayer language style of people who speak English in prayer, and kind of great revolutions. I remember when we were at Valpo, how can we call God a shepherd? We don't know what shepherds are. Well, you know, now it's, well, should we call God king? Or queen or monarch, or so it's been a very interesting time to care about the language of worship, because there's been so much really world questioning about what language we should use when we pray. Why I'm here is I got conversing with some of the staff, and they said Holden was doing this great 40 year in the wilderness. And I said, well, isn't that funny? I just finished writing a book for Fortress, which will come out in October, where I took the readings of the lectionary. I'm a member of the ELCA, and most ELCA churches use a lectionary called the Revised Common Lectionary. It's slightly different from the one that's published in the front of the LBW. That was an earlier version. The Revised Common Lectionary is growing in use all around the world by Lutherans, Episcopalians, Methodists, Presbyterians, UCC, a great collection of Protestants all around the world have looked at their lectionaries, that is, lists of readings that are appointed for Sundays and festivals. And they said, you know, there's some problems with our lectionary. And then they started to revise it, and boy, that's a lot of work. And so maybe what they said is, oh, let's use the Revised Common Lectionary. So in fact, it is very similar to the Roman Lectionary, but in some interesting ways different. So it might be that in 50 years, there will be just three or four important worldwide lectionaries. The Roman Lectionary, the Revised Common, Eastern Christians use a different lectionary. But there's really an amazing consensus about this lectionary. And I care a lot about those readings. So what I had done for this book that's coming out is I had taken all the readings and read them very carefully to see what are the images that are in the readings. What are the, Christmas Day. You know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So why do we read that on Christmas Day? Well, it's about light, and it's about winter solstice, and it's about the birth of Christ. That's what I mean by image. A word or a picture that's used that becomes important for the way the Bible reading is told. For example, for Paul, Lutherans know a lot about it. It talks about forgiveness. Well, the image behind that is the image of the judge. The idea that God is a judge or like a judge. And you are going to be held accountable before that judge. I teach at a university, and you know, we get so used to forgiveness, forgiveness talk, we might not think, you know, the image is of a judge, and my 20-year-old students do not think God is a judge. They think God is a friend. Well, suddenly you realize they could be listening to epistle reading after epistle reading, and none of it is really clicking with them, because it's based on a whole image that is not part of their spiritual vocabulary. So that's what I mean by images. But what I had done was decided to write a book on 40 images. So the Holden Village people were all excited. You know, 40 images, 40 this, 40 that. Come, Gail, and do all 40. I said, no, I don't think we can do all 40. But, you know, battle, body, city, clothing, day, shepherd, wisdom, prophet, mother, family, food, light, homeland, poor, Israel, marriage, creation, covenant, garden, judge, you know, should I go on? Fire? Okay. How I got them? I didn't cook them up before. I really read all the readings. You know, take the three lectionaries and you read every reading. And you say, what are the images of this reading? And then I tabulated them. Because the lectionary may not even have the same kinds of images that a biblical scholar might come up with. Because the lectionary is a selection out of the Bible. And so there might be some biblical images that are used less or more in the lectionary than they might actually be used in the Bible. Would it be helpful for you to be asking questions as I go? Any questions just so far about that?
Could you look at images that are used that don't show up in the lectionary?
No. I became aware of some of them. Mm-hmm. Or I realized that sometimes people want the lectionary to function in a certain way, and so they complain about the lectionary because it doesn't function that way, because that was not the intent of the lectionary. You know, there are many things you can do with the Bible. And so I became more aware of that. But a very good example, one example is punishment. There's a lot in the Bible about punishment. And there is very little of that in the lectionary. And you might decide that was a good decision, you might decide it was a poor one. But one could see the idea of God punishing would, now I don't know what I would say the image was. I guess you could say that an extension of the judge image. So there's certainly leanings. For example, one of the images that I dealt with was the image of the outsider. Now, if you would just actually go through the Bible, the outsider has a pretty hard time. There are a lot of rules about the outsider and a lot of where God says, ignore the outsider. Well, Sunday's reading, huh? Last Sunday, okay? Jesus tells the disciples, don't go to the Samaritans, huh? Just go to the children of the house of Israel, all right? So there's all the way through the scriptures, or look at the book of Revelation, what happens to the outsider, all right? They are not going to enter the kingdom and eat from the tree of life that we talk to. But clearly the people who designed the Christian lectionary don't feel that is the way, how would a Lutheran say it, that's not gospel. Mm-hmm. Gospel is the outsider comes in, okay? So that you get many more stories about, last week, Jesus touches the dead body, lets the bleeding woman hang on to him, okay? All these kinds of things where the outsider is brought, Christ embraces the outsider. That could be argued that that's only part of the biblical message. So that's the kind of thing that became real clear when I went through this. So what I thought I could do, not all 40 images, but I thought, well, Holden, what would be the images that people would care about if they were here? Well, we all journeyed to get here. And we're up in the mountains. And, well, if you've got me around, you always have the Tree of Life. That's my sort of personal favorite image. Light. I understand that the first day that Holden is very conscious of light because of how it's not light here in the winter. So thinking about light. And of course, we're at the time of the summer solstice. And what was the last one?
Water.
Oh, water, because of the beauty of the Cascades here. So I thought, well, those would be pretty obvious for Holden people to care about. And then actually, as I looked at the days, it really made a lot of sense. Today in the Lutheran calendar is the commemoration of Onesimus Nicene, who I knew nothing about, so I'll tell you all about him. But he also lived a life of journey, and we are all journeying here. So remembering Onesimus today is journey. And tomorrow would be the last day that we live under last Sunday's reading. And you remember in the first reading in Exodus, they're all at the mountain. Okay? Yeah. Anytime there's a mountain in the Bible, pay attention. Something big is going to happen. That's what I would mean by image. You know, it's not just, oh, you know, they're down the block. No, no, they're at a mountain. Okay? And we're going to miss some of the layers of meaning of the story if we don't think mountain. So not only are we here in the mountains, but Saturday we can remember back to last Sunday's reading where in Exodus they're all up at the mountain. Monday is the birth of John the Baptist. It's in fact, of course, in the ancient times it was the summer solstice, which is exactly then 6 months before the birth of Christ, and I was going to talk about that and talk about light at Vespers. Tree of Life, and Tuesday do water, and it felt that that could even fit in quite well with the fact that Tuesday is the day of the presentation of the Augsburg Confession. As you can see, I love the lectionary, I love the calendar of commemorations. It always gives another layer to every day. Okay? It's not only today, it's, oh, this day, and this day in the lectionary, and this day in the calendar, sort of, and get all the layer and stuff. So I thought I could do a little bit with Journey today. And if we can start by grabbing a hymnal that's near you and go to 343. And we'll do two stanzas. 343. Guide me ever, great Redeemer. We'll do the first verse, and then which is the one that goes open now? Is that the second or third? Second?
Okay.
There are hymnals here and there. Throw them around.
There are lots more over here.
Cheers. Okay. Or just listen to the rest of us. La, la, la. I'll say we'll do one and two. God be ever grace, Redeemer, pilgrim through this barren land. Journey. there are positive journeys. This is the first time I'm at Holden. It certainly is a journey to get here. Though I don't know if we'd use that word for coming here. My sense in thinking about the word journey is that most people I know have probably never really had a real journey. We've taken trips, and we've gone on vacations. What are other words? Journey, what?
Travel,
yeah. Journey seems to me to have more peril and uncertainty than I know that I've ever had. I mean, you know, in
come
air condition.
Come in the winter, it's got plenty of
heat. Maybe that's true. That arriving here, you know, where it's arduous. So I've tried to think a lot about the word journey. I don't know if any of you saw that PBS series a few months ago on the homesteaders in Montana.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a joke compared to really homesteading. They walked for 2 days. That was no journey to get there, okay? The homesteaders walked across the United States and like a third of them died on the way, you know? I mean, many of us don't really experience the uncertainty, the peril, the adventure that might be in the word journey. But I think coming here, even in the winter, is probably a pleasant experience. Certainly a retreat camp is going to hope that your journey here was pleasant. But of course, a lot of journeys aren't. I think it's interesting about Holden picking the 40 years in the wilderness to kind of play off of, because of course there was no like retreat center, right? It's always understood as the arduous time of testing, of hunger, of trial, that you want to get through to the other side. The difficulty of journey. Today is the day that the Lutheran calendar asks us to remember Onesimus Nasib. He was born in 1855. He's an African. He was kidnapped and sold as a slave in Eritrea. He's from Ethiopia. Was from Ethiopia. He was bought by some Swedish missionaries, Lutheran Swedes, who then freed him, catechized him, and he became an ardent Christian apologist. He translated the entire Bible into the language of Ethiopia. Died in 1931. Certainly, you've got a bunch of journeys there, huh? The journey of his life, both being kidnapped and then the journey back to his people, the journey into Christianity. The Swedes, whatever they were doing down in Africa. So a combination of horrible journeys and much more blessed journeys. So we stand in memory of him today. Many religions use journeys either literally or figuratively in their religion. I want to think of some. Certainly we've all gotten to know a lot more about Islam now. One of the five pillars of Islam is that if you can possibly afford it, that at least once in your life you will make the journey, the Hajj, to Mecca. And of course, people who can go off and go as often as they can. Christians sort of played around with the idea of pilgrimage as journey. And that seems to have started in the fourth century with the story? It's such a cool story. It's actually a Tree of Life story about Constantine's mother. You know, when Constantine became a Christian, actually he was not baptized till his deathbed, but as he was kind of moving towards Christianity, his mother, Queen Helena, did the first kind of Holy Land tour, went over to Jerusalem and found all these things, like the steps Jesus had walked up when he was interrogated by Pilate, and actually went out to the hill outside of Jerusalem, and they dug up three crosses and didn't know which one was the true cross, and they laid the true cross on a dead man, and he came back to life, all right? And this was the finding of the true cross, the billions of splinters of which, you know, have covered the world ever since. So she started, you know, popularized the idea that it would be nice to go back to the Holy Land and go back to those places. Christians, though, have never required it. And of course, it's had a checkered history, the idea that you had to make a literal journey. Christians have said where Christ is in the bread and wine in this community. You don't have to go to Jerusalem for it. And while some people, I don't know, do you have any congregations that have like water from the Jordan River that they throw in the baptismal font? Mm-hmm. You know, like Ben right now, a lot of Christians will just smile at that. But you're like, you know what? The water that rained, that was just fine. This water, you know. It doesn't have to be some other water. So literal journeys have not become really important in Christianity, though they certainly are in some other religions. I'm interested in the Buddhist journeying up mountaintops that often is supposed to incite religious enlightenment. In fact, what actually physiologically happens is you get up so high you get lightheaded. And so, in fact, you do have an experience of altered, you know, consciousness. And maybe it's related to religion, and maybe it's related to oxygen deprivation. And maybe those things are related. So some religions, you know, advise it, some require it, some sort of, you know, allow it, it's fine for you to do it, but it's not necessary. Have any of you, you know, been to the Holy Land, or has that been religiously important for you to take such a journey? Yeah, well, Old Testament scholar, right? Yeah. Was it religiously important, or was it scholarly important, or both?
I thought it would only be scholarly, but it was. It turned out to be religiously important. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect to. I mean, when I was an intern, the pastor got a trip to the Holy Land, and he went to Norway. So I didn't expect to think that the Holy Land would feel any holier, but it did something. Yeah.
Did the people who contributed to the Holy Land Fund know that he went to Norway instead?
Yeah,
fine
with that.
What a hoot.
The other Holy Land, right?
Oh, well. But while there is certainly some history of Christians making this journey. The most famous is an amazing woman whose name is usually translated Egeria. We know virtually nothing about her. She probably lived in the early 400s, late 300s. So if Christianity is popularized in the early 300s in the Roman Empire, okay? Constantine 313. Right. So maybe 50, maybe 100 years later, you did have people following Queen Helena and going to the Holy Land. And one was a woman, clearly a woman of great learning, enormous status, because bishops would meet her at the city gates and welcome her. She stayed in monasteries, and she would always dine with the abbot. She wrote a diary to her sisters, and it is not clear what that's all about, because the convents that we might think of didn't exist at that time. So who she was, what she was, where she got her money, how she had her status, none of these things we know. But she wrote a very detailed account of her trip to the Holy Land. And so scholars have just been delighted to find this thing. And she really did the kind of thing that Muslims do. She really retraced as much as she could. She was very biblically knowledgeable. And so she would organize her trips in order. She actually follows the children of Israel all around. You know, what does she say? Next, they showed us the enormous rock on which Moses broke the tablets that he was carrying. Next, we were shown the place where the 70 received the spirit of Moses. And then the place where the people of Israel had lusted for food. So I think it was, they've been doing this for a long time, you know, sort of religious tourism. But it is very interesting to see this early account of a Christian journeying to holy places. But mostly in the history of Christianity. See, part of what I wanted to do was not only see what the scriptures had to say about these images, and I'll get to that, or what the lectionary had to say about them, but think about them just in general. Think about the word. Think about them in world religions. I think about them in contemporary phenomena, okay? So how does journey function? In most of Christianity, though, the journey language has to do with your interior spiritual journey. So a lot of monks and nuns wrote about it as though living the Christian life was this arduous journey. Some of you would know the name John of the Cross. We ought to note carefully the words our Savior spoke, how narrow is the gate and constricting the way that leads to life. Christ says the gate is narrow to teach us that entrance through this gate of Christ, which is the beginning of the journey, involves a divestment and narrowing of the will in relation to all sensible and temporal objects. Doesn't this sound like a very strict monk, huh? Where you've gotten rid of everything that you can get rid of? As this path on the high mountain of perfection is narrow and steep, it demands travelers who are not weighted down by the lower part of their nature. You could find in many of the monks and nuns' spiritual writings this kind of talk about journey. However, most of us in this room are probably Lutherans. What did Luther do with all this? I mean, Luther tried this. Right? He was big time into the image of journey as the spiritual quest. And of course, he kind of threw it all over. He said, you know, you can't do it. You can't do the journey. And so we shouldn't be surprised, those of us who are Lutherans, that there hasn't been very much journey language in our religious life. But I think it's picked up more. What would be your sense about it? 25 years ago, those of you who are younger, 50 years ago, those who are my age, would journey have been a thing that you would have thought about in adult forums or confirmation class? Would it have been Lenten talk? My sense is no, until quite recently. Anybody?
I agree with that.
Yeah, and I think it would be the Lutheran sense that the journey is God's journey to us. Not so much, you know, that Christ is God journeying to us and we receive it gratefully. But that's just a sense that, well, not all Christians are Lutherans, you know, and that other Christians may use that language a great deal more. It would still be quite alive in Roman Catholic monastic circles, the idea of the personal journey towards God. But I think it's also picked up the last couple years. I don't know, have people heard more of it recently? Like, what context would you, in a churchy situation, have journey used, you know, besides coming to Holden?
Lenten
journey. Yeah, that's really interesting. Lenten journey. And of course, now, you know, that gives me a little homework. Lent 50 years ago, even Lent 30 years ago, was focus on Christ, right, and the Passion. In the new lectionary, the Lenten focus is on baptism. And I wonder whether the baptism focus then brought in the idea that the Lenten journey is our journey back to the font, for example. That's one of the ways that you see it used in the lectionary. Or where are you in Lent? Those of you who think Lent journey, where are you going?
Easter.
The cross.
The resurrection.
Creep back to the font.
Yeah, creep back to the font. That's Luther talk, you know. And whether it's the font we're going back to, is it, is it more communally oriented? Is it more Christ oriented? That's a good project. Okay, take the last 10 years of everything Augsburg Fortress published, and see how the word journey is used. How is it being introduced? I am wondering to what degree it's also come about because of the relative affluence of our people, and so the ability to do things like fly across the United States and journey to Holden. Mm-hmm. my grandmother would never in her entire life, have done the journeying that I've done in the last 48 hours. The fact that we can take journeys, we can afford them. We're not milking cows every day. Oh, any farmers here?
They couldn't come. They couldn't leave the cows.
Yeah. You can't leave. Cows. Right. I remember. Miriam, do you remember when I took you guys to our cousin's farm? She was the yeah. And we said, well, what do you do like for vacation? She said, vacation. I said, are there cow sitters that come and milk the cows? No cow sitters. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that, Lutheran farmers of 100 years ago who were big into Christ journeying to us would not have had that much in their hymns. Well, then what we have to do is get all the new hymn writers, That's the kind of thing the hymn writers are doing now. What are the images, the ideas that we don't have in the hymnal because we have a new life experience or we view that image differently?
It seems like there are a number of authors or books, the idea of journeying inward,
yes,
to find peace there, and then you can journey outward to other people. I can't name authors, but there's a lot of that.
There's a great deal of it in current, at least popular psychological language, all right? That in order, which is of course a very interesting thing. The Amish teach their children that the word for the Christian life is joy. Jesus first, others second, yourself last, J-O-Y, Well, of course, a therapist wouldn't talk that way, all right? The therapeutic revolution would say, if you don't have yourself in order, you're going to be a pain in the neck to everybody else. And we have to have serious Christian conversation between what does the Christian tradition mean that God comes first, others come second, yourself comes last, when in fact a current sense of the self, probably for one thing, defines the self differently in order to get a different order. But certainly if you have to get yourself in order first, then things like journaling become very important, which are journeys into the self, absolutely. And just walk into any bookstore now, and the entire section that's blank books, all right? Isn't it funny? We spend $20 for blank pieces of paper because we're going to write this magnificent stuff. So it has to be in a magnificent bound book as we do the interior journey. I know that a lot of college campuses are big into the labyrinth. About the labyrinth?
We have one.
Oh, you have? A lot of retreat centers are big into the labyrinth. Labyrinths can be used in many ways, but certainly sometimes what the labyrinth is a kind of bodily journaling exercise.
Physical prayer.
Yeah. Where, and in fact, sort of reminds me the Native American, numbers of the Native American tribes. The necklace that I have is a Navajo one, but where you have this maze, and the person, the idea that the life journey is finding the center of the maze, another journey thing. Anne, did you have your hand up before when I was talking? Oh, you're okay.
Yeah, I was,
all right.
The medicine wheel and the labyrinth and mandalas in the center of circle of life all seem to have something in common, and it's a rebirthing. The symbolism of going on your journey and being rebirthed, as we are after we pray, rebirthing. And I think with popular religions sharing ideas now that had kept secrets for hundreds of years and now are opening, a lot of the religions are opening up for examination, because this seems to be a time of people understanding that life's a journey.
Yeah. And what would we have to do? Let's say we'd spend the whole week on journey. How is it used, you know, in Islam? How is it used in these new sort of American spiritualities? Okay, some of which come directly out of nature religions. How has it been used in the history of Christian hymnody? All right, so the next boring sermon you're in, you just go through all the hymns and look for the word journey. Okay, so how did our forefathers and mothers in the faith think of that word? And it would be really interesting to sort of list them all out. Because my sense is that when we are sitting and for the gospel standing for these readings, these words come at us like journey, right? What has been the journey experience of the people who hear that word? What has been the religious use of that term? What is the difference between how the Bible uses journey and how the labyrinth uses journey? I mean, I think they're quite different. And how do they complement each other? How is there a dialogue between them? And then, of course, the most extreme would be when Christians would say, well, I'm really interested in what you say about that image, but we say the absolute opposite, you know? And we're certainly at a time now where we are extraordinarily open to the way other religions and traditions use images than, for example, you know, when I was a kid, where, you know, that was just all. And anybody want to add to it? I mean, that sort of is how I would talk about the deep interest of for this, you know, this quest for me. I mean, let's take my example with my students, judge. They don't think God is a judge. One of the exercises I take my religion classes through to give them a sense of what the Bible is that we read Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9, which are the two intermingled flood stories. Well, everybody in the class has some vague sense of the flood. Usually not a single person has actually read the two stories that are there. But I will always have students very upset that God sends the flood to drown everybody. That part of the story they've never heard. And that would be an example of God is not a judge. Well, if God is not a judge, why do they need forgiveness? You know? So what is the current sense of those images in order that we know what we are speaking to and with when we read the scriptures? And, you know, journey would be another example.
I know time is not, this is not forever, but do you have a sense of how or why these images evolve? I mean, why these kids don't have like images of judgment, and now there's more imagery? I mean, it seems like there's an evolution in the imagery that the church uses, that we use as individuals.
Oh, sure. Well, I think that'd be great.
That'd probably be a whole other session.
Well, I think it would go image by image, you know? What was it, about 5 years ago, a group of prominent Anglican bishops and priests, you know, published this a theological statement that, you know, hell didn't exist. And there was a hue and cry. You know, half the people said, well, we knew that about 200 years ago. And the other people said, why bother be religious if you're not afraid of hell? So that would be an example where you could actually date things. I mean, some of them I think can really date, mm-hmm. where you could say something happened. Next week in Philadelphia, the great book that the Anglicans used in the great Philadelphia Anglican Church on July 4th, 1776, they crossed out the prayer for the king. And every year they show that great Book of Common Prayer that had written out in red the prayer for the King of England. The Anglican churches changed their prayer life after the Revolution and got rid of a lot of royal language, not only for the King of England, but God is King. There was much less. If you go to England now and pray in an Anglican church, I think you'll be struck. God is just King, like all over the place. So you could say, well, the American Revolution, you know, would be an example. So sometimes it's history. I mean, certainly now the whole business about God is He, you know, has to do with the women's movement. So I think sometimes, and other times I think it would be much harder to figure what is it. I mean, I think that I was teasing about that before. Do we think different? I certainly think differently about journey than my mother or grandmother, who took whose life did not give them journeys. And they didn't think about journaling. They were just doing the laundry, for heaven's sake, you know? Right. So that actually I come to journey out of an enormous privilege of my life, you know, internal and external. So I think that'd be a great project, sort of take these images and see, gee, how can we even see why they've changed over time?
I mean, I guess the curiosity is like with the Revised Common Lectionary, some of the changes came because of changes in our own imagery that we were using, that they either draw those back in to the lectionary.
Oh, yeah, certainly, yeah. And of course, the Revised Common Lectionary is 3 years with 3 readings per Sunday. Mm-hmm. The lectionary that most of us grew up with was 1 year, 2 readings per Sunday. Oh, and also, of course, the Revised Common Lectionary has the full psalm, and the psalms are filled with images. So we have very much more multiplied the number of images for God, for the Christian life, for the community, than would have been there in my childhood. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You mentioned that our mothers and grandmothers didn't have the privilege of journeying in the way that we do now. Were they the worst for it? I mean, we sometimes feel like, oh, we have, in order to really be fulfilled, we have to be able to go on our spiritual journey. But they never could, you know, they had only time to do the laundry.
Right.
As you said, are they the worst for it? Or did they really participate in a journey in a very different way than we now see?
Oh,
yes.
Oh, I think their life was arduous in a way that my life is not. So I don't know that they would have used the word journey for it. Do I think they had difficult lives? Absolutely. I do not romanticize the past. I've read too much history. It was a hard life.
But to see the journey that the great-grandmothers made, and then to have their daughters reflect on the journey they made to get to this country, I mean, maybe they didn't want to travel. They heard their mom tell stories of traveling and the peril to get to this
absolutely.
Country.
No, that's very good.
Getting here.
Muhlenberg's journals, which are just astounding. He talks about his journey to the States from when he left seminary and came over as a missionary. The ship ran out of water, and he writes about the rats in the night licking the sweat off of all of them, because the rats were as thirsty as the people were. This was not a cool cruise. Yeah, I mean, it was horrible. So that you could actually go like generation genuinely had. So all I would say is that, of course, they had arduous life. I don't know that they would, how they would use the word journey, you know, if they're, would they have connected it with the journey of the people of Israel? Would they not have? And the interior journey, I don't know, we have to go, let's go interview all the 80, 90, 100-year-olds. What do they think about all this contemporary talk about the interior journey? That'd be a great project.
Well, of course, in the history books, I mean, talking about coming to America as manifest destiny and stuff. I mean, there was that idea that, I mean, they did somewhat right. connect with this idea of journeying to a promised land. I mean, there is all that talk in the history
right.
books.
You there know, would certainly
Millinger
be.
Millinger in his history right. book talks about that, you know.
That would be... And for some of the Christian communities coming over, that was very important, that they really did adopt that language. And of course then, well, it was religious in the way that they could have the religion they wanted.
Sure.
It wasn't the way we would think about it more in contemporary talk about a spiritual journey.
Yeah.
We're not quite. Was there someone down there? Yeah.
I was just remembering the whole Dutch Reform experience in South Africa and the Great Trek, which I think ended up being a very powerful image and got very involved with their view of religion, too, that this, because it was connected with the Exodus.
Okay.
And I'm not even sure where they were trekking from, but I know that they came down through Africa to get
right.
to South Africa, and I think that became a very important image for the Dutch Reformed, I think, was people in South Africa, the Boers.
You know, you open up a really scary thing. Christians, you know, for 2,000 years have adopted biblical language, being sure that they were using it in an appropriate way. And maybe later Christians didn't agree or thought that they had gone over the edge on that image. So, you know, was the trip... you know, I mean, I think we would have a hard time talking about the pilgrims coming over here and stealing the land from the Lenape and saying that that was, they had come to the promised land that God gave them. That we would find that they had overused or misused or used with too much self-aggrandizement, biblical language. I think biblical language always goes in both directions. And, you know, I began that by saying, well, there's good journeys and bad journeys, you know. There are journeys into the wilderness, there's journeys to the promised land. And that it would be interesting to see when Christians have appropriated that language and used it, what, uncritically? Like, we know that this is our journey, we know God's on our side, and God's leading us. And,
what's that George Bush talk right now, in some ways?
You know, he uses a lot of biblical imagery.
Yeah.
He really does. Yeah.
So you sort of began by juxtaposing the asceticism of John of the Cross
right.
with a sort of modern journey as material privilege.
Oh,
But it seems to me that all throughout the Bible, is that along with journey, there's a sort of refutation of material goods and the old, you know, the Hebrew scriptures. You know, that the Israelites, while they're waiting for Moses to come down, melt all their gold trinkets into an idol. And in the New Testament, the young man with many things is sorrowful because he can't get rid of his things to come and follow Jesus. There's this association with your stuff is holding you back from the journey.
Right. But of course, by Acts, the church needs money to support itself. So, you know, it, always look at the biblical context for those stories. Is this a biblical book that's saying God's on the side of the poor? Or is this a biblical book that's saying, hey, cough up your money, we've got bills to pay, all right? So I think both messages are there. Yeah, no, and I did not, I also didn't mean to say that all of our journeys are only towards affluence. But that that some of the literal journeying we do, even some of the interior journeying we do, if I was working as hard as my great-grandmother, I would not be doing a great deal of interior journaling. I would be, you know, I would be trying to get food on the table. And so I don't mean that as affluence, but I think that the just is an example of the way that the word is going to function differently for different groups of people. And I teach my students when they want to say, you know, what did women do at a certain time in history? Always, oh, the rich women or the poor women? All right? Which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the poor peasants, or are you talking about the bishops and the palaces? You know, and so be sure that you're looking at a large enough. You know, you're looking at both sides. We have just a few more minutes because I want to actually get to the lectionary. It seems to me that the way the Christian Church uses the Bible in the lectionary and according to the church year is that it pulls out stories of individuals who go on journeys, but who are always then sent back to the community. So you have Elijah walks to the mountain of God, but he's immediately sent back to the capital city. Okay? You have Jesus going into the wilderness, but in order to come back and begin the ministry. In Pentecost, the disciples are sent out. That the idea in this that the scriptures have a communal, it all ends up being communal, right? So it would seem to me that the journey cannot be solely an interior one if the church is talking about it. That to what extent the personal journey is a part of one's life choice. That would be very different depending on your socioeconomic background, depending on your life choices, how much of that you do or are inclined to do. But that whatever is like the journey comes back to the community. So if the baptismal, if the Lenten journey is a journey to the font is always the entire community washed in the if the journey is to the resurrection, the resurrected body of Christ is this community. So to the extent that the journey is a personal or private journey in the church, it always ends up being for the good of the whole. What would I do? I could have brought the list of the readings that I found the journey image in, but I'll leave you all to do that. When do you see? And you have variations of the journey. You've got Paul talking a bit about things like the race or the goal or the prize. It's a kind of journey, a race. You certainly have the whole Exodus story. Let me say a little bit more about why I've gotten so interested in images. I was raised in the Missouri Synod and was educated as if Lutherans were fundamentalists. So for example, I memorized the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. Why? Because it was taught me that that was true history. It was accurate history. And as an educated Christian, I should know it. So that gave me a reason to read the Bible. Luther was not a fundamentalist, as I'm sure some of you know, and the major Lutheran tradition has not been fundamentalist. And certainly, almost all of our seminaries, Christian seminaries in the United States, Roman Catholic, mainstream Protestant, certainly most Lutheran seminaries, have not taught fundamentalistic Bible teaching for 50 to 75 years. Sometimes what trickles down is still fundamentalism. But I can pick up the New York Times and read the latest that probably the 40 years in the wilderness did not exist. All right? That the latest biblical theory is that whoever came to be Israel was a combination of nomads who had come into Canaan and resident Canaanites. You see a little glimpse of this if you read real carefully. Read Joshua's speeches, where Joshua is saying, those of you who came from across the river and those of you who were here, all right? That there's there were numbers of Semitic peoples who came together. And how much that whole history of the Exodus and the wandering in the wilderness, what its factual basis is much under discussion. Well, I know that, and I know it on Sunday morning when I'm hearing the readings too. All right, I'm not a fundamentalist. It's easier to be a fundamentalist. Lutherans never were. Remember Luther.
How do you define fundamentalist?
To believe that the Bible is more or less, that what it means for the Bible to be the Word of God is that it's more or less factually accurate. All right? And that the truth lies in its facticity. Right? This happened. I can trust it happened because, you know, Jesus walked on water, and so he could save me. All right? And why did I know Jesus walked on water? Because the Bible said it, and the Bible is...
That literal.
It's literally true.
Okay.
Right?
Thank you.
Thank
you. A lot of different things.
No, thank you. I should have made that much clearer. Lutheran tradition has never bought into that completely. Luther's, read his prefaces to the books of the Bible. They're just funny. Like he'll say, well, this book of the Bible, don't really bother with it. Doesn't really have much gospel in it. You're not like, okay, there goes that book. Don't worry about the book of Revelation. He said, read it where it belongs, last. All right? It's not going to help you out. All right, well, there's someone who's judging value of the books of the Bible and, the, you know, not saying this is like a history book. Well, to the extent that that's what everybody's learning in seminary, in many, many Christian seminaries in certainly Europe and the United States. So why should we read this stuff on Sunday morning? You know? Why should we hear last Sunday that the people of Israel gathered Moses at the mountain, and or that the people of Israel went on this journey, or that in the Sundays after Christmas, Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus journeyed to Egypt to escape the slaughter of the innocents. So when the journey, that the Magi, who are not three kings, by the way, they are the Magi. Maybe there was 30 of them. And Magi would include men and women. Okay? So they weren't three kings. They were seekers of truth. And they journeyed to follow a star. So what do we mean? Why are we reading these things? Well, you can see what I suggest is that the images can bring us real life. We have all lived now through September 11th and have in our minds images of death. Turn on the TV news. You will get images of death. I think to live deeply, to live lovingly, to live in community, we also need images of life. Life, images that give us life, images that we can check with one another. So we know all week long, there are Christians all around the world who read that Matthew text last Sunday, who read that Exodus text, who are starting to slog through the book of Romans. All right, we're going through Romans now. All around the world, Christians holding those images before them. So that's one of the reasons of my fascination for images, is it says, all right, what would be my journey? How does the journey function for me? How is it like biblical journeys? How is it different from biblical journeys? How do I need the scriptures to call me to a more Christian journey? All right, which it seems to me is always back to the people. Go back and, you know, there's old Elijah hiding in the cave. God says, forget it, go back. All right, you can't hide in the cave. So the move from the self back to the community seems to me a recurring way the scripture uses it. Does it jog anything for anybody?
Well,
anybody want to argue with me?
That the Bible is more than a list of facts. Oh, I mean, there's something more in the meaning.
Yes.
Like you're saying, it almost sounded like you were taught that it is a list of facts.
Well, it was a list of, it was fact, it had meaning because it was true. Well, what is truth? I mean, that's a very good question, huh? I think the greatest American novelist, William Faulkner, said, "I'm a novelist. I write the truth. When I need a fact, I make it up."
Well, Ray McKeever's thing is, all the stories I tell you are true. Some of them may have actually happened.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that said it all.
So it seems to me that then what happens is some of it maybe happened. Well, you know, some of the Israelites had a nomadic past. I don't think there's any question about that. Then how can that ancient memory of a nomadic past, where surprisingly they met God in the wilderness a number of times on their journeys, how can that bring life to us on a Sunday morning or here at Holden on a Sunday evening? You know, I think that's... and it can't do it the way it did it for my childhood. It can't do it by saying, you know, 1776, you know, learn that date, such and such a date, learn that date, and you will know God because you know about this biblical history. It seems to me we can't pretend that anymore. I think there's a Lutheran debate about that right now. You know, certainly the Missouri Synod is caught in that debate, the Wisconsin Synod. I think many of us are caught in it interiorly. My students will say, oh, well, it doesn't matter, the Old Testament didn't, that's all, you know, like Noah's flood, but boy, everything in the New Testament is bad. Come on, let's admit it, right? Like, that there's, we're all scientists. We want something to be a provable fact, and then that we can rest in that. And I think the faith of the church is not like that. It's a different, you know, as you said, it's a different thing. And we have 9 minutes to go and experience that. So thank you for being here. I hope you have fun with Journey Image and with whatever images come up every Sunday. It's one thing to do. Does your parish give you the readings the week before? All right, get the readings the week before the Sunday. The Sunday, listen, because you've been working on them all week long. You got them the week before. Or get yourself, you know, this is what, $3 from Augsburg Fortress, okay? That you can follow along so that you're steeped in these readings before Sunday morning. You've got the images already going in you to receive the readings.
At the beginning, did you discuss where the lectionary comes from?
Oh, no.
Are you going to be doing that sometime?
Would you like me to?
Yeah, I would like to know that.
Okay, what days are you going to be here? I think the group chat, are you all, half of you are gone now tomorrow, huh? You're in and out? No, I'm glad to do that. If you, it's a very interesting history. I can do it the 2-minute version. You want the 2-minute version? The Western Church and the Eastern, we don't know the history of lectionaries. Augustine talks as if there seem to be some readings that, of course, everybody uses on certain times. But we don't have any ancient records of lectionary. The synagogue had a lectionary, so probably Christians adapted the idea. By the Middle Ages, the Western Church and the Eastern Church had very different lectionaries. The Western Church had a 1-year lectionary revolving around Easter and Christmas. Luther said it's a perfectly good lectionary, just preach it better. So some Protestants kept the 1-year lectionary. Some Protestants, like Calvin, said it was horrible and he threw it out. So some Protestants did keep the 1-year lectionary. Lutherans were among those that did. Second Vatican Council, it's taken more than that. Second Vatican Council, Roman Catholics said we need a better lectionary. They got a committee. The committee made up the 3-year lectionary. Protestants all around the world saw it. Lutherans said, it's really good, but we need a little more a little more Paul in there. So they made the Lutheran version. And Episcopalians said, well, we need a little bit more beautiful poetry in. So they made the BCP version. Then the American Protestants got a hold of it. And they said, well, we need more social justice in there. So then they got the Common Lectionary. Then about 15 years ago, there were all these three-year lectionaries. And an ecumenical committee said, we got to get this organized. And so they worked on it for several years, and that's the revised Common Lectionary, and that's the one-minute version. Let's go pray. If you've got more questions to ask me, I'll be glad to deal with it.